You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Whilst a great deal of research and numerous publications have focused on Sasquatch sightings in British Columbia, the other provinces have a rich history of encounters with hairy bipeds. In his new book, Sasquatch Canada, our old friend W.T. Watson collates almost 200 encounters, from drive-by sightings, sightings by both hunters and law enforcement officers, and many more strange encounters. Despite what slanted official explanations may lead you to believe, these are definitely not misidentified bears. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, bonus content, competitions, and guaranteed early releases. Thank you to my latest patron, Emma B., and thank you to each and every one of you for your continued support. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. We've finally gone over 2,000 subscribers, so thank you to everybody on YouTube as well. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, merchandise, and more. Thank you as always to Dean Bestor for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. To the second largest country in the world now, where around 80% is barely habited by humans, it seems the rest is where the Sasquatch roams. On this episode, we head to the Great White North, on the hunt for Sasquatch in the company of W.T. Watson. In his new book, Sasquatch Canada, W.T. takes us on a trip around some of the provinces that make up the second largest country in the world. British Columbia seems to have monopolised our big hairy friend, but as Travis's book will show us, this is certainly a countrywide phenomenon. W.T., welcome back for your fourth appearance, as we finally worked out prior to the show.
Thank you so much for having me again, Paul. We were joking earlier about me becoming a co-host, and I think, yeah, as many times as I've been on the show, sometimes I feel like I ought to.
This is, my foray into the Sasquatch, into the Sasquatch realm. And as I said in the introduction to the book, I had some reservations about doing a Sasquatch book, because the topic can be so controversial. You have people who are very set in the idea that the Sasquatch is a bipedal ape or hominid that's just undiscovered, and then there are people who have other beliefs about Sasquatch. And a lot of the sightings in Sasquatch, very much like any other wildlife sighting, a hunter, they see a Sasquatch, just like you'd see a bear or a cougar or, a moose or a deer, except, of course, that this creature isn't supposed to exist. A lot of the sightings that we come across are like that. But then there's also a chapter in the book called Strange Things that has some of the odder things that happen around Sasquatch that make you wonder. And I'm probably going to end up exploring more of that strange stuff in the follow-up book to this, which I was talking to my publisher today. Looks like we're going to get a contract for that too. So there's more to come.
Well, that's the thing about Sasquatch. Once you step foot into it, it'll pull you down.
Ugh. Yeah, it's become a rabbit hole. And people might wonder a little bit about the title of the book. It's called Sasquatch Canada Beyond British Columbia. Mm. And as we were discussing prior to the show,
one of the things that happens with people that write about Sasquatch is that a lot of the Sasquatch or Bigfoot people tend to be south of the border. They tend to be in the U.S. And so they write a lot about U.S. sightings, U.S. encounters. And if they talk about Canada at all, it's usually British Columbia. Because it's contiguous with the Pacific Northwest and you know, you kind of continue on up the coastline there. And there are a ton of sightings in British Columbia. Don't get me wrong. But what I wanted to do in this book was I wanted to say, you know what? There are a ton of sightings throughout Canada. in my research, my notes probably have something like 200 visual sightings in them. Obviously, all of those didn't make it into the book because I don't want to repeat myself over and over and over again. I like to keep my books kind of compact and try to pull out sightings that people will find interesting or encounters that people will find interesting. I found either visual sightings or at least historical accounts of Sasquatch in every province in Canada except Nunavut. And I suspect that's simply because Nunavut is not a very populous area. And the people that live there, the tribal people, the indigenous people that live there, they're not as eager to talk about Sasquatch as maybe some people are. So I'm sure that there's probably been some encounters up there. I just was not able to find anything documented.
I think often as well, when it comes to this particular subject, there is often this kind of perception, as we've discussed on previous episodes, and I've spoken with other researchers in a variety of topics, Travis, that some people are extremely reticent in coming forwards because they see what happens to people who brave the media or coming forwards with a real encounter, or how they feel, and are often dismissed as people who clearly don't know the back end of a moose from a tree, to people who will mistake a large bird for some other kind of winged creature, to people who mistake a waterspout for a sea monster. So often people will find themselves dismissed completely out of hand, regardless of their background, their experience, their job, their age, their sex. It doesn't seem to matter. Often there is a ready-made excuse for any sort of sighting of a strange creature, regardless if the fact doesn't fit the explanation template that often gets wheeled out in these subjects.
Yeah, you know, I have, you know, discussed this in previous books, and you know, I take a swipe at it again in this one too. You know, there's such an intense ridicule factor that goes with actually being a witness to any of these paranormal phenomena. But you know, whether you're talking about Sasquatch or UFOs or, you know, any of the sea monsters, lake monsters, you know, as we discussed in Canadian Monsters and Mysteries episode, you know, all of the people that see these things, you know, the scientific materialist viewpoint wants to say, okay, well, there's an explanation for this. Now, in Sasquatch's case, particularly here in Canada, the most common thing that I saw in, you know, documented sightings where people talk to their relatives or friends or whatever is, oh, you saw a bear. Now, realize that there are very large bears in Canada. You know, we have brown bears in Canada. So we're not talking, you know, I mean, think about your Kodiaks and grizzlies and those kinds of bears. There are some big bears here. But one of the things that you find as you do research in this phenomena is that, you know, Sasquatch typically are described as, you know, they're being bipedal and moving on 2 feet very smoothly and very quickly. Now, anybody that's seen a bear walking on its hind legs, you know, whether you've seen it in the circus or, you know, seen it at the zoo or whatever, yes, bears will get up on their hind legs. They will do it to reach things. They will, they may take a few steps on their hind legs, but they don't walk bipedally on a regular basis, and they're certainly not graceful about it.
No.
In addition, when people describe seeing a Sasquatch, they almost invariably describe a creature that has shoulders. I mean, you know, like a linebacker on a football, on an American football team. You know, in fact, more than one witness described the Bigfoot as looking like a football player with all the pads on and stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're so wide, have almost no neck, which is completely different from the profile that a bear standing on its hind legs is going to present, with the arms kind of drooping down. They don't really have shoulders. They just have these paws and they're sticking out front. And there's not arm swing, you know, when a bear's moving on two legs. Whereas you do definitely get, arm movement from, according to witnesses from the Sasquatch. So, I'm sure that a certain number of sightings are probably misidentifications. it happens in all fields.
Yeah.
Somebody gets excited and they see a bear, or they see, the back end of a moose or something like that. And they, maybe they're primed to think Sasquatch, and, they're, oh, look, it's a Sasquatch. Oh, boy. Yeah. But for every one of those sightings, there are dozens of sightings by, very, very credible witnesses who are, either trained observers or who are hunters who have spent years out in the woods. They know what the wildlife looks like, and they know what they saw. I've got, testimony in the, I've got documented cases in the book from people in the Canadian Forces, from police officers, from forestry people. Lots of hunter accounts, outdoors people that spend a lot of time in the woods. These people know their wildlife and they know what they're looking at. And what they're describing is not anything that's in, the zoological books at this point. Now we can argue back and forth about what it actually is, but the thing that I always want to put across to people, when, especially when talking about Sasquatch, is that the witnesses are seeing something real. It's real to them. And we have to acknowledge that. And this whole business of you saw a bear, or you were dreaming. There's a couple of those for nighttime sightings. You must have fallen asleep and dreamt something. That kind of condescending attitude is what makes Sasquatch research, or research in the paranormal, so difficult. Because people know that there's going to be a certain percentage of people who are going to think they're nuts, or they're lying, or they're delusional, or or they just don't know what they were looking at. And when you're a special operations soldier in the Canadian Forces, and you see a Sasquatch at a range of about 30 or 40 yards, you know what you saw. You're a trained observer and you know what you saw. So, that kind of stuff bugs me, because, if people would take the time to actually look at the evidence instead of just going, setting it aside out of hand, they'd find some really, really, really interesting encounters out there.
It is infuriating, because I think you can apply this to all kinds of strange sightings across the board, that, as you say, people are often dismissed by their age. Oh, well, if you're a child, you clearly don't understand anything, which I've often found remarkable, that children are only able to tell the truth about certain things that people will accept, which, and they're always dismissed. Well, you're too young. You don't know what you're looking at. Well, I think when you get to sort of 9, 10, 11 years old, you're very aware of the world around you. You know, we have children that go through education. These are not children who have just literally been released into the world for the first time at 11 years old. And especially in this day and age, they have access to more information than they've ever had, Travis.
Absolutely.
You have people, like you say, who see things at night. The often trotted out explanation for some of those, apart from dreaming, is people hallucinate. I've never, ever met someone who has hallucinated
a sighting of a strange creature, personally. You know, I used to work in the license trade. Often people would be... This seems to be something that seems to have fallen away in recent years, thankfully. But the old adage was, oh, well, people are drunk. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you work in the license trade, you know how much alcohol it takes to make people hallucinate. And usually those people will not be doing anything other than lying down and wanting to go to hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because by that point, you've acquired acute alcohol poisoning and you're about... halfway to dead.
Yeah.
I love that one. The drinking thing. Oh, you must have been drinking. It's like, well, even if I was, you know, even if I was a little tipsy, so how many people do you know that go out and knock back a six pack or whatever and start hallucinating?
Yeah.
That just doesn't happen. In order for a person to hallucinate, you have to have a very specific sort of brain condition to make that happen. You know, high fevers will do it sometimes, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, your average Joe who's sitting out in a tent next to his, you know, next to his hunting area, just kicking back a couple of cold ones, to dismiss his testimony just because he had a few beers is just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. I mean, that one, that's one that gets me going too. Yeah, I mentioned that one in the Phantom Black Dog book, if you'll recall. Yeah, because there were a lot of people who got that. You know, oh well, you saw this big black dog with glowing red eyes. You know, you must have been drunk, right? Yeah, it's like, no, I was not. I may have been riding back from the pub, but, you know, I was riding back from the pub. I wasn't, you know, falling down drunk or anything.
Yeah. And you would suggest the amount of people that own dogs that go to the pub and have a drink, Travis, we'd be seeing red-eyed dogs all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, there, as you say, there's a certain, I think that it has to do with fear, honestly. It's, you know, if we allow that these things might be real, then that's going to completely crack our paradigm, how we see the world. You know, and I think that it's very much the case that people who have these experiences do often experience a paradigm shift. You know, they become more open to, you know, other strange things because, you know, if you see the Sasquatch, then if some guy tells you that he saw a UFO, you're like, well, yeah, who knows, maybe.
Absolutely. I think a prime example of this, and I know nothing else I'm going to mention in this episode is probably based in British Columbia, but this is a prime example of exactly what we've been saying. So there is a very famous video from Squamish in British Columbia from 2011, where a wildlife biologist, a gentleman called Miles Lamont, was on the top of a mountain and spotted a strange creature running, it looked like, on the footage, up this snow-covered mountain. He came forward, released the footage, and then a local sort of celebrity known as Ridgewalker Pete said, oh, yeah, that's me. So the guy went, well, I could see this creature. He had no backpack on, no hat, no clothes. It was a hairy creature. So he said, oh, yeah, but he's probably mistaken. So hang on a minute. You're telling a wildlife biologist he doesn't know what he's looking at, first of all. And then secondly, he said, oh, yeah, well, I was there in that area at that point. When they checked the diaries, this chap was there 3 weeks after this video was filmed. So, but that's where the story ended. As far as everybody's concerned, if you look at it now, people go, oh, yeah, he saw this guy. Well, he didn't because the dates don't match at all. Right. And he's a wildlife biologist. Are you telling me a wildlife biologist can't tell a man walking up a mountain?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and that is exactly the kinds of thing that you see, though. So people will reach for the most ridiculous. Well, you know, the classic example is the swamp gas thing in UFO.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, well, you saw swamp gas, or you saw the planet Venus, or you saw a flight of birds flying overhead, and the you know, the the lighting from the city caught their breasts just right so that they look like lights. And some of the explanations that people put forward for these phenomena are more ridiculous than the phenomena themselves. I mean, yeah, I can understand how somebody could think that, oh, well, you know, it must have been a bear, or, you know, you saw the back end of a moose or something. But some of these, some of the explanations put forward for paranormal phenomena are just ridiculous in and of themselves. You could probably write a book about ridiculous explanations of, you know, paranormal phenomena.
Yeah. I think as well, as there are several accounts in the book, Travis, that these people are not 30, 40, 50 feet away. I mean, there are some that we've mentioned, like the Canadian Armed Forces chap is a prime example. But you've got people who are within feet. If, and with the greatest respect, if you're that near to a bear, I don't think we'd have heard that story.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what kind of bear it is, for one thing. You know, the black bears are not as aggressive as the brown ones. But yeah, you know, if you're standing that close to a grizzly bear or something, chances are, you know, you should be laying down and playing dead. Because he's liable to decide that he doesn't like you a whole lot. I mean, there's a story in the book, you know, you're talking about children. And any time I hear, you know, somebody talk about children and think about Sasquatch, I think about this story. There's a story from John Worms in the book that's set in Manitoba. And he tells a story of a young lady. Her name was Carrie. And Carrie is a First Nations person, Ojibwa. And at the time of her encounter, she was out doing a chore. She was getting water for the house. They didn't have running water in a particular place. A lot of the First Nations people in Canada live in pretty primitive conditions. And this was back in the 60s. Well, as she was coming back, it was berry season. She did two things that all the search and rescue people will tell you are big mistakes. The first is she wandered away from the beaten path, from the area that she knew. Then when she realized that she was lost, she ran. I was a search and rescue volunteer for a while. One of the things that we told people was, if you get lost, if you can, if it's safe, stay where you are, because it makes it much easier for us to find you.
Yep.
If you're out wandering around, you can get missed because you were one place, the dogs hit your scent somewhere else and went off in another direction, and then it takes us that much longer to find you. So, I mean, eventually they do, because you leave a scent cone, but it's just easier if you stay in one place, as long as it's safe. Well, this young lady, you know, took off. I mean, she's running and she's crying. She's terrified. She's out in the woods. It's getting dark. It's in, you know, far northern Canada, so it's an under forest canopy, so it's already dark. And then when it gets dark, when the sun goes down, it's pitch black and you can't see a thing out there. She runs until she exhausts herself. She ends up, you know, spending a little time laying in moss under a tree, manages to sleep fitfully. And this goes on for a couple of 3 days. You know, she keeps running and looking and walking and searching and trying to find her way back home. And she's getting more and more lost. And she's convinced that she's going to be eaten by a bear. So, you know, to add to her fear, she's convinced that in the night something's going to get her. Well, second or third night that she's out, she thinks that her nightmare has come true because she hears something large moving in the brush. And she's like, she starts talking to this thing, whatever it is. And she says, "Grandfather," which is a term of respect. She says, "I know that you're a bear and that you're going to eat me. So, you know, I'm going to ask that you eat me head first so we can get this over with," which I thought was kind of amusing. But, you know, whatever it is circling her and seems reticent to approach her. And eventually, though, whatever this is gets close enough to her that she can actually reach a hand out and touch it. And she said it's like It was like putting her hand on a beaver pelt, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing has eaten her, and she's like, okay, well, I don't know. She didn't quite know what to do, but she got up and she started walking. And as soon as she did that, whatever this was bumped her. And she thought, oh boy, here it comes, right? She's sure that she's going to be attacked now. But nothing happens. And she walks on a little ways. And as she goes off in one direction, the creature, whatever it was, would bump her. And then she'd go off in another direction. And if she went too far in the other direction, the creature would bump her again. And they're making their way along in the pitch black night. And of course, the sun starts to come up. And then she really freaks out because she realizes that what's bumping her is a Sasquatch. Now, she doesn't know what this thing is. When she is finally located, she tells the first person she meets that she was saved by a bear that walked on two legs. But they knew what she was talking about. But anyway, they're walking. She freaks out for a little bit, and then, you know, she kind of decides that this thing is not going to attack her or eat her or whatever. So she keeps walking, and it keeps bumping her, and it's guiding her along a particular path. And eventually she comes to the tree line and she looks out and she realizes that she's looking at an area that her tribe cleared recently for an airstrip. A lot of these settlements get their supplies and whatnot from in their medical attention and so forth from aircraft. Mm. You know, aircraft will come in, pick them up and take them off to quote unquote civilization, you know, and bring supplies in. So she recognizes this, and so she knows where she is, and she runs out, and she finds the road, and she looks back, and this creature has disappeared into the forest, right? She sees a truck coming, and lo and behold, it's an older man and his son that she knows. They're from the village. So they pick her up and they take her back, and she tells the old man, I was saved by this bear. He's like, what kind of bear? And she's like, this bear that walked on two legs. I said, oh, I know what you saw. And so he tells her, I don't know what the Ojibwe word for Sasquatch is, but he tells her what it was.
Mm.
They go back to camp. Of course, her parents are overjoyed because they were sure that she was lost, right? That she'd been lost to them. She's much the worse for wear, scratched up, and her clothes are torn, and she's just a mess, right?
Mm.
And she tells this story, and you know, her sisters all start to make fun of her. Now, you know, she becomes known as the girl who touched the bear, right? But interestingly enough, her parents, you know, basically are like, yeah, you saw a bear or whatever, you know. But the old man who picked her up told her later that he had had a very similar experience when he was a boy, and he got lost in the woods. And one of these creatures was bringing him fish to survive on until he found his way out. So, you know, we see a lot of these Sasquatch stories where, you know, either you see this creature at a distance or maybe even up close, but it's, you know, it's kind of a wildlife thing. But you also get the ones where this creature seems to be very territorial and wants you out of its territory. I was reading and this isn't in the book, just making sure Sasquatch doesn't have a completely bad reputation. I was reading in Tom Powell's The Local story about a young girl who is deaf, who her father had a drinking problem. And one night she looked out her window and saw this creature, this Sasquatch, Bigfoot, they call it Bigfoot down there, carrying something. And it walks up and deposits somebody on, basically the front lawn. And she does whatever it is that she did, because she was deaf. She did whatever it was she did to get her mother's attention. And they found her father out on the front lawn. And it turns out that he had crashed his truck like 3 miles down the road. And this creature apparently had picked him up and carried him back.
No, not at all. And I think as well, it's that when you sort of really chase some of these down, you will find, because often we've got this sort of storyline where certain areas, they will have this ingrained belief that Sasquatches will carry off children and women for whatever reason. Travis, regardless of where you are, there will be certain tribal law or certain First Nations that will have this, you don't go out at night. And I know there are several stories in the book where children are warned about the bogeyman or things like that to keep them inside. And to be fair, as you know, as we've mentioned previously, there are certain predators wandering around, regardless of any sort of creatures of this description that we're covering here. When we're talking about encounters with Sasquatch, there's enough out there to take down small children if they're unaware of what's going on. So often this is usually the thing where when children have these kind of encounters, as we were saying about the excuses that are often put forward, children are told that they're dreaming, they're seeing things, they're hallucinating, they've got such a vivid imagination. And yet it seems to me more incredulous that a young lady would make up a story about being guided out of a wood by a strange creature than simply say, well, I mean, why would you say that? Why wouldn't you just say, I found my way home, luckily?
I wandered around until I found my way out. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and this is the other thing, you know, when you talk about children being witnesses, it's like, sometimes they're the best witnesses because they don't filter things. You know? They don't have as many preconceived notions as adults do. And so they'll tell you exactly what it was they saw. And, you know, it may be weird, but that's what they saw. And then they'll stick by that story. Yeah, I don't think that, you know, I mean, very young children sure may have, you know, threes and fours may have some trouble distinguishing imagination from reality, but you know, by the time you get them into school and so forth, they're plenty old enough to be able to tell you what they saw.
Yeah,
a lot of times they saw Sasquatch.
yeah. I think one of the other excuses that's put forward, and this is probably one of the best examples of this because it's one of the best known encounters that occurred in Alberta, which is obviously what happened at the Bighorn Dam in 1969. One of the explanations put forward for dismissing everybody, because this is one of those sightings as well where you've got numerous witnesses, Travis, is that it was just a tribal hoax, which I find quite a dismissive kind of explanation that, it's one of those, they might as well say, well, you know what those people are like, as though it's just a polite way of being intellectually brutal about people that you've got no concept of, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the Bighorn Dam did have, to be fair, some opposition from the local indigenous folks, primarily because they were going to flood some of their lands, which, you know, I mean, I wouldn't be too happy about that either. But again, you know, you have a situation where, if I remember correctly, the first witnesses were three guys who saw this thing at this creature at a distance. I'm thinking it's a half mile or so. But they had, and they didn't have, like binoculars or anything like that. But the thing made enough of an impression on them that they went to the site where it was and tried to determine how big it was. And this is another one of those things about Sasquatch research that just makes me crazy, is we don't know what these creatures are, but there are people out there who proclaim themselves experts and will dismiss testimony because it doesn't fit into their box. And this was a classic example of it, because when these guys went to the site where this creature was spotted, the ridge where this creature was spotted, they determined that the thing was somewhere between 12 and 15 feet tall.
Yeah.
And so, of course, some Bigfoot researchers were like, oh, no, that couldn't be, because, you know, Sasquatch are no more than 8 to 10 feet tall. I'm sorry, you're talking about a bipedal hominid that may or may not, or ape that may or may not exist, and you're telling me that it can only be this big? Yeah. How do you know? You know, and I use the example in the book. I'm 6 feet 7 inches tall. I'm a big guy.
Yep.
Now, the average person in average male in North America is something like 5'11" tall. Does that mean that I can't exist because I'm taller than the average person?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd for somebody to say, I'm such an expert in Sasquatchery that, you know, I can tell you how tall this creature is supposed to be. And not only did they do that, but they went to extraordinary lengths to come up with a theory as to why these people, you know, thought they saw the Sasquatch that was 15 feet tall. Mm. You know, well, it was standing on original. And yeah, I mean, they drew diagrams and did all this stuff. It's like, and it's just ridiculous. It's like, we don't know how big these creatures can get. You know, and the fact of the matter is that not just in the Bighorn Dam area, but throughout that area of Alberta, there were sightings of what people would think of as abnormally tall Sasquatch. There are two or three of them in the book.
Yeah,
you know, maybe they just grow big there. I don't know. You know, whatever the heck a Sasquatch is, I don't think we can say, oh, well, you know, the average Sasquatch is 8 to 10 feet tall. And, you know, people who are reporting 15 foot Sasquatch must be mistaken. It's like, how condescending can you be?
Yeah.
You know, trust the witness. If the witness says they saw a Sasquatch that was that tall, then they saw a Sasquatch that was that tall.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, but then not only that, but you also had people in the local indigenous community that were seeing these things on a pretty regular basis.
Mm.
So it seems pretty evident to me that there were, you know, maybe a group of these creatures, animals, whatever you want to call them, in that area. And that, you know, they were getting sighted on a fairly regular basis. And, you know, this is another one of those, you know, you were talking about the whole, you know, those people thing.
Yeah.
This is another one of those things that makes me nuts is I'm just the opposite. It's like if a indigenous person around here favored me with a story, I would have a tendency to believe them unless I really thought they were pulling my leg for some reason.
Yeah.
Because these are people who grow up. Typically, yeah, I mean, not everybody, but a lot of these folks that grow up on these reserves up here in Canada, you know, are in intimate contact with the wilderness all the time, you know, and a lot of them, you know, supplement their food stores and so forth with hunting and fishing. A lot of them work like the lakes, you know, netting fish and, you know, as fishermen and so forth. You know, they're very, very conversant with the wildlife in their area. And if one of those guys tells you they saw a Sasquatch, I think there's a pretty good chance they saw a Sasquatch. You know, they're not going to be mistaking a bear or a, you know, the back end of a moose or whatever for a Sasquatch. They know the wildlife in that area. And they would, you know, if they tell you that's what they saw, that's what they saw.
Yeah.
You know, there's, but again, you know, you have that same situation, as you say, where there's kind of an almost racist attitude about indigenous people giving testimony, you know, those people, you know, don't know their, you know, can't tell their myths from reality.
Yeah.
In that, you know, those people, if you want to put it that way, come from a different culture, which has a very animistic view of the world. Yeah. But, you know, for instance, the people, the native people of Canada have kind of an overall teaching that they do about these seven virtues. And each of the virtues is represented by an animal, you know, like a wolf or a bison or something like that. Sabe, which is one of the words for Sasquatch or Bigfoot up here, is one of the animals that they use to represent one of the virtues. I think it's honesty.
Yeah.
which is interesting. So to them, these creatures are real. Now, they are, you know, they're every bit as real as a wolf or a bison or any other kind of animal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And if they say they saw one, then they saw one.
Yeah. It is one of those things I've often found when certain cultures are being examined or investigated or people are researching them, that this aspect, especially when it comes to Native American and First Nations tribes as well and their nations, Travis, the totem is a prime example of this, that the vast majority of creatures on a totem are easily recognizable. Or when you have petroglyphs in certain states in the US, you will have a full range of all known animals, and then there'll be a big hairy creature there, and people and certain people will go, well, yeah, that's just made up. Well, hang on a minute. Well, why is it there then? Why is it not on its own? Why is it surrounded next to a wolf or a bear or an eagle? We accept the known animal because they can say, well, that's definitely an eagle. But when there's a hairy biped on a wall or part of a totem, they go, oh, well, that's just a myth. Well, why is it a myth? Why is it there? Why is it the only myth? Why don't we have totems made of entirely imaginary creatures then?
Yeah, and you see the same thing with totem poles in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. You know, the Sasquatch, whatever they call the creature in their native tongue, are carved right into these poles, along with all of the other natural wildlife that lives in their area. To them, it's just another creature in the forest.
Yeah.
Kathy Strain's book, Giants, Cannibals, and something or other. I can't remember the whole title to it. Yeah, I mean, this creature is a part of Native lore all throughout the United States and all throughout Canada.
Yep.
Yeah. What for all, from the tribes over in British Columbia all the way across to the tribes in Newfoundland.
Yeah.
They all have some word for this animal. You know, and they're pretty blasé about the fact that it exists.
Yeah.
Now, you know, some of them, go on to say that it's, to some of them, it's a protector of the tribe. To some of them, it's a protector of the forest. You know, to others, it's the boogeyman. You know, so it just depends on what tribe you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I talk a little bit about that in the book as well. There's some information on native beliefs about these creatures.
Hmm. I think the other interesting aspect about the whole Bighorn Dam incident was that obviously René de Hinden was there.
Yeah.
And he showed them the Patterson-Gimlin film. Now, here's the other aspect of all this that I've often found very interesting. One of those parts of this particular account, Travis, that I think gets overlooked, that when they were shown it, they said, no, that's not what we see around here. Ours is taller and thinner. It's not as well built. And it's we usually see the male, because obviously they could clearly see it was a female in the film. That, for me, gives more credence to it as well, because if they were making it up, they'd say, oh, yeah, that's it. That's what we've seen.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Yeah. They said, no, it's not the same.
No, it doesn't look like ours. and that's, again, you know, as I said, a lot of these people have grown up in intimate contact with wilderness, and they know their local flora and fauna. And, you know, it's if they tell you that their creature doesn't look like, the creature in the Patterson-Gimlin film, that doesn't discount the Patterson-Gimlin film. It just means that, you know, Sasquatch have more than one body type, apparently.
Yeah. And I mean, there are strange little aspects of this. I mean, obviously there were several sightings near to the David Thompson Highway, which is quite ironic, I think, because obviously Thompson is one of the people who wrote the first one of the first reports about uncovering strange tracks, which he passed off as a giant bear, I believe, or a gigantic bear, because he just couldn't explain it. So the fact that some of these sightings that other members of I think that a lot of the people around there were Cree, weren't they? That some of them were seeing sightings like that is just one of those little strange coincidences. You think,
it's one of those synchronicities that makes you go, Because David Thompson is the guy who, you know, in his journals describes finding these gigundous tracks and wanting to believe that they were the tracks of a grizzled bear, is the way he put it.
Yeah,
but he knew better, and so did the people he was tracking with.
Yeah. I think as well, there are several sightings in the book, quite a couple from Alberta, where the witnesses will describe themselves as a complete skeptic about the situation until it happens to them, Travis. And they're usually the best ones for me.
Yeah, I love those stories. There's one in, let me think. I think it was in Ontario, because the witness was actually a Toronto police officer. And he's out doing his thing. He's moose hunting, which is a thing here in Canada, apparently. I often wonder, because moose are so big.
Mm.
Like, okay, if you shoot a moose, how do you get it out of the woods? I'm sure there's, you know, there's some technology that they use to do that. I mean, I know some of these guys going on four-wheelers and stuff, but I've always wondered, you know, because a deer, you can, you know, I mean, they're heavy, but you could pack a deer out. You know, you take turns and whatnot. Yeah, a moose, though, there's no way you're going to pick that thing up. So they've got to drag it out somehow. So they must have to use a hoist or something. But anyway, I digress. So this fellow was, you know, he was going out to hunt moose. And, you know, Toronto police officer, had something like 20 years on the force. You know, this is not a guy who got spooked easily. Spent a lot of time in the woods and a lot of time, you know, dealing with wildlife on the streets of Toronto. So, you know, he's not gonna, you know, freak out at the first sign of something odd happening. So he is, he's on a four wheeler, one of those ATVs with four wheels, right?
Yeah.
He's separated from his partner and he's setting up to hunt. The weather is not particularly good. It's raining off and on. He actually, you know, is spreading moose urine around and doing all these things to, you know, and doing moose calls and stuff, trying to attract a big bull moose, right?
Yeah.
And he set himself up next to this game trail because he figures that if something's going to come, it's going to come along that path, right? So he's sitting there, he's waiting, he's got his rifle, you know, in a holster. It's a big holster that sets down along the side of your ATV. And he hears something coming in the brush, right? And he looks up and there's a moose, and he's like, oh boy, yeah, he's gonna get his moose for this hunting trip, right? So he's starting to unsheathe his rifle when something moves off in the brush, and this moose looks up and does something that he's never seen before. It takes off. I mean, it turns and beats feet. Now, those of us who've lived in Canada for more than 30 seconds know that it takes a lot to scare a moose.
Yes.
They're notorious for just basically assuming that wherever they go, you're going to get out of their way. There are any number of people involved in car versus moose accidents every year because moose will just stroll out into the middle of the street. If you hit one, it's liable to take the top of your car off because they're huge and they're tall. So a lot of people, you know, end up coming to a bad end from being in a car versus moose accident.
Yeah.
And they don't scare easy. You know, there are any number of reports of hunters who just almost walked up to one.
Yeah.
And they won't move. And if you happen to run across a bull moose in rut, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because it is the second largest land animal in North America by weight after the wood bison. So you don't want to mess with a moose, right?
No.
whatever stirred off in the brush there, you know, caused this moose to decide that it was getting out of there.
Mm.
So this fella's like, okay, what the heck is going on here? And he hears, you know, crashing and banging in the woods and then nothing. And he's like really disgusted because he's standing there and it's raining. So he decides, puts his gun back in the holster, his weapon back in the holster. He decides he's going to camp out on that. And since he saw a moose coming up that trail, he's going to camp out on that trail. And he spends the day there. You know, he takes a nap. He has a few cigarettes. He's watching the trail, just waiting for something to happen, right? It's getting late in the afternoon, but he's one of those people that won't go back in until it's dark, right?
Yeah.
It's getting late afternoon and he hears something coming down the trail again. And he's like, okay, maybe that moose is coming back.
Mm.
He's looking around and Then he hears it kind of going off road, and he looks down into, he moves forward a little bit. He looks down into a, I think it was a creek bed or some kind of depression. I believe it was a creek bed. And he sees this creature walking along this creek bed, kind of using the trees as, you know, walking sticks or leverage to keep its balance as it's walking along on the stones and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's big and it's dark colored and it's got no neck. And he's like, what the hell am I looking at? Because Sasquatch was like the farthest thing from his mind. You know, he said, I've been hunting in those woods for 20 years. I'd never seen anything like that. Didn't put much stock in it, right? He was a skeptic. He's a police officer. He's used to dealing with facts and, you know, figures and testimony and all that kind of stuff. He sees this thing walking along in the creek bed, and he just, he doesn't know what to make of it. And he doesn't know what to do, because he's looking at this thing and he's looking at his rifle and he's thinking, I don't know if that would take it down, you know, and he's carrying a weapon for shooting moose, right? He's carrying a large caliber rifle with him, and he's looking at this thing and thinking to himself, I don't know if I want to take a shot at this thing. You know, maybe discretion is the better part of valor. He packs himself up and he gets the heck out of there. And he joins his hunting partner, and his hunting partner is astonished to see him, because this guy is diehard. He never leaves the woods before dark, and it's, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he says nothing to anybody, you know, until he actually makes his report. I think I got that one out of the BFRO database, you know, until he actually makes a report, because he's, you know, I mean, first of all, because of what he does. If I recall, he told his wife about it. And his wife actually went on and did some research and found out that there had been a number of sightings in the area that he'd been in. So he felt better about actually making a report. But, yeah. You know, I mean, he didn't want to, he obviously wasn't going to give his name or anything, because cops are brutal about teasing you if you do something unusual, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, so that's a classic, you know, I mean, this guy was, I mean, you know, he might have thought about it, but he certainly was not thinking that he was going to run into a Sasquatch that day.
Yeah.
And he certainly wasn't a believer in Sasquatches. But there you go. You know, he runs into one out in the woods while he's hunting.
Yeah.
Trained observer, you know, good line of sight. Could tell you exactly what he was looking at. You know, he was convinced. he knew what he was seeing.
Yeah. I think a lot of one of the striking aspects of the book is that a lot of these witnesses are not people searching for Sasquatch, believe in Sasquatch, even have an interest in it. These are people from all walks of life who, for better or worse, Travis, depending on their opinion, because a lot of people have had a very strange reaction to these encounters, are absolutely steadfast in what happened. I mean, one of the best ones from Manitoba is Archie Motkaluk, who was so incensed by a news broadcast saying that Sasquatch was all nonsense that he went, no, I'm not having that. I saw something happen 50 years ago, and I've never told anybody, and it's true, it's real. They are out there, which I think is remarkable that he was so incensed by the tone of this news broadcast that he just went, right, I've held this in for 50 years. I've got to let everybody know. And he ended up being something like 8 foot away from it.
Yeah, and he actually kept a diary. You know, or scrapbook of his experience that he shared with people after he came out, basically, you know, with drawings and whatnot of his experience, because he was out chopping wood and he saw this creature, you know, from a distance, like 400 yards. And at first he thought it was a person walking toward him. And as it got closer, he realized that it wasn't a person walking toward him and that it was coming right at him. And he's standing there with an axe in his hand going, oh, no, what do I do? You know? Because an axe isn't going to do you much good against a, you know, an 8 foot tall, 800 pound biped. But, apparently, the creature passed on, it looked at him, scared the bejeezies out of him, but then just walked, across the creek and kept going. You see this so often with Sasquatch behavior. It's almost like either you're in their territory and they want to get rid of you, or, they're passing through and they see you and it's like, okay, whatever, just keep going. But that brings to light, too, one of the real common things that seems to happen in Sasquatch encounters, particularly close-range Sasquatch encounters, is the unreasoning terror that some people feel when they encounter one of these creatures. There's a theory out there that terror is caused by, low-frequency vibrations that these creatures are capable of making. I don't know. That could be. Tigers do that. I suppose it's plausible, but one of the things that we find, though, is that a lot of people have a really an unreasoning reaction to these creatures, and all they want to do is get away from them. You would think, you're out in the woods and you see something that very few other people have ever seen. Myself, I would be like, I hope that I would be like, oh my gosh, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch this thing closely while I can still see it, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people, though, are like, no, I'm out of here. I want nothing to do with this. And it doesn't even have, the creature doesn't even have to be that close to them for them to have that kind of reaction.
Yeah.
So, but then you get the stories like Carrie, where the creature walks up to them and touches them, and they're scared because they think that a bear's going to eat them, but they don't really have that terror reaction to the Sasquatch. So you wonder if the creatures are creating some kind of a field that makes people afraid when they want to get rid of people.
Mm. I think as well, often it's overlooked, and I think we just presume that these creatures aren't curious either, Travis.
Yeah.
I mean, with the greatest respect, I would suspect that less Bigfoots have seen people than people have seen Bigfoots and Sasquatch,
Yeah, probably.
So I think, because often you will hear sometimes that people will have encounters and the creature looks really surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I know when Archie was saying when the creature appeared, they both stared at each other and then they both backed off. It's like they were like, "Who? What the hell are you?" From both sides of it. So
where did you come from?
Yeah, what are you? Why have you got no hair? How do you keep warm? What are you doing out here in the snow? That kind of thing, really. And so when you see these kind of encounters, I think often people are so shocked. I think one of the key aspects of this is at the end of the day, they're seeing something that they've constantly been told all their lives doesn't exist. It's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So that alone would create a real conflict immediately, because everything you know about the world has come crashing down around your ankles at that precise moment, Travis.
Exactly. And as you say, a lot of times these creatures look kind of surprised to see people. Or, we have there's a story in the book of group of indigenous people who lived off in the wilderness had actually reported to their local RCMP station, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, that one of these creatures was coming into their encampment, and it kept looking in their windows. And so they were basically complaining about a peeping Tom Sasquatch, right? Which I found rather amusing.
Yeah.
There's a story in the book about a young man who's he's wanting to join the Canadian forces, which is much more competitive than it is in, say, the United States. And so he's been off at a friend's house, studying, because one of the things that will make him more competitive as he tries to get into the forces is having good grades, right? So he's been off doing study, and he comes home late at night. It's probably 11 o'clock or so. Comes home, and he's getting undressed for bed. And he looks in the mirror and he sees a dark reflection there in the window behind him. And at first he thinks it's his reflection in the mirror. And so he does the thing that you do, you know, where you wave your hand or whatever. And he realizes that whatever it is standing there looking in the mirror at him, or looking in the window at him. And he turns around and he is the width of a double bed away from a Sasquatch that's looking in the window at him. And he freaks out. You know, he basically, he's actually sitting on the bed. So he turns and he looks, and this thing is right there, you know, with the reflecting red eyes, the whole smear, right? This, you know, this giant head looking in the window at him. He loses it. He's down on the floor, crab crawling away from the window, screaming at the top of his lungs, right? Mm. His parents come in, and of course the creature's gone. And they're like, oh, well, you've had a bad dream, right? I didn't go to sleep. You know, I hadn't been to bed yet. I wasn't even undressed yet. Right. and he's so insistent that his dad actually, you know, goes, all right, well, we'll go look. And, you know, they don't find anything conclusive, but, you know, it does look like something was standing outside his window. Right. Yeah, I mean, these creatures, I think, are curious about us as we are about them. The thing is that they are much better at stealth than we are. You know, so, because, you know, you have any number of stories, you know, where, yeah, sometimes you hear them crashing through the brush. And I think sometimes that it's because they want you to hear them. Mm. Because you have any number of other stories where these creatures are silent as a wraith in the woods. You don't know they're there until they pop out of the woodline.
I think one of the strangest encounters is another one from Manitoba, I think, which was that lady who was going through a divorce and went for a walk in the woods.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Here again, we've got a lady who's a veterinarian technician, Travis. Mm-hmm. This is a lady who's quite clear of what kind of animals are. She lived in the area and she was going for a walk. This is the strangest thing, because it's one of those situations where you stumble at something that seems a bit peculiar. And she finds these two snakes, which she thinks is a bit odd. One's been killed, and I think she said one had been crushed or twisted oddly. She's obviously quite used to handling animals, because she picked one of the snakes up and puts it back in the grass, which I think is remarkable.
And yeah, she was a wildlife rescue person.
Yeah.
So she was very conversant with the wildlife in that area, because she'd had, you know, some of these critters in her house, you know, nursing them back to health. So
and as she's dealing with this, she just sees something. I think she says she's about 200 feet away, 200 meters away from something. Mm-hmm. And she thinks that a bear's having a poo in the lake. She says it's defecating.
Yep.
And it's only when it stands up that she suddenly realizes that there ain't no bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this begins a very long and very hair-raising series of sightings, really, where she was walking along a pathway that led next to a dam, if I remember correctly. Mm. And she is some distance from her vehicle. And she doesn't want to turn her back on this creature or these creatures, as it turns out. So she's walking backwards along this path, keeping an eye on what's going on behind her. And it's a good thing that she's doing this, because during the course of her sighting, the one that was in the lake comes back up on the shore and sees her and makes some sort of a noise. And there's a response from a copse of trees, off to her, that's to her right. I think this is off to her left. Mm-hmm. So she's pretty sure there's at least two of these creatures there. And as she's going along, again, backing slowly away from these creatures, trying to be sure that she keeps an eye on them, You know, there's a vocalization from that copse of trees, and it's answered by the one that's visible to her. As she's backing out, though, there's some loose rocks and boulders and things off to one side of her that lead, you know, kind of down an embankment. And she hears something and realizes, you know, as she's backing by this, that one of these creatures is actually coming up the embankment. And it was to her mind, it was trying to flank her or even come up behind her. So at this point, she backs away from the embankment where she sees this hand coming up over the top, and she turns and flat out runs back to her vehicle and then does a ridiculous speed getting back home and behind a locked door. So one of the scarier encounters in the book.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, there's also one young lady who's a trustee for an airsoft course, which is it's kind of a war game thing that they play over here. I don't know if they do it in the UK or not, but encounters a set of Sasquatch, and she was a cross country runner, takes off, has a bad feeling about going on a path that would lead her directly to her vehicle, and decides to take a side path. And realizes as she's making the Y intersection that there was another one of these creatures in the woods along that path there.
Mm.
She would have had to run right by it as she was going out. So it's almost like these guys are very organized, and you wonder what would have happened in the cases like the one where the one was coming up behind this woman on this dam path or this young lady at the airsoft course. What would have happened if they'd actually run by the Sasquatch, you know, and gotten within reach?
Mm.
You know, we do have these native tales of them, of the creatures taking women. And we don't know why they were taking women. We don't know if they were a part of their diet or what, but we probably don't want to know.
No. Yes, I think anybody that's seen Willow Creek will never want to camp in the woods again anyway.
Yeah.
To be honest.
And there are a certain number of witnesses who, after seeing a Sasquatch, refuse to go back in the forest again. Now, a lot of them do. A lot of them will, you know, after the shock is worn off, will be okay with it because they figure it's a one-time event. But, you know, there are a certain percentage of people who witness a Sasquatch that never go back in the wilderness again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's one of those things that just makes you question everything around you. And you just don't, you know, yeah, I'm sure some people will think it's the most incredible thing they've ever seen. And some people will think it's the most terrifying thing they've ever seen.
No, there's a certain percentage of people that won't go back in the wilderness again. Then there's a certain percentage of people that decide that they want to go see if they can have another sighting, and they go off looking for them.
Yeah, yeah. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
I think one of the most intriguing collections of sightings is one of those situations that we don't get a lot of, where you have a creature that's quite distinctive. And this one comes from Ontario and is known as Yellow Top or Old Yellow, because this one seemed to have some kind of hair colouring that marked it out. And yet people were reporting this particular creature for over six decades, which is remarkable.
Yeah. Now, the question in my mind is, you know, with Old Yellow Top is, okay, it is kind of a rule of thumb that the larger the creature, you know, the shorter the lifespan, particularly if you don't have, you know, like modern veterinary care or whatever Sasquatch would require, right? Medical care, I suppose. You know, they probably would have anatomy similar to ours, given that they're bipedal and sort of hominid or ape-like. But were people seeing the same creature over that span of 60 years, or was this a, you know, something genetic that was passed along to offspring that were seen, you know, along this course of time? Because, yeah, we had sightings of Yellowtop, you know, in the early 1900s. And I think the last one was in the 70s, which was a pretty scary one, because the this area, Cobalt, has a large mine. forget what they mine there. It's copper or nickel or something along that line.
Mm.
And cobalt, of course. But there were miners on a bus going to the mine that had a close encounter with this creature. And again, the driver describes, and one of the miners describes seeing this creature. And, you know, it had basically like a blonde, it's basically like it was a blonde, right?
Yeah.
You know, the rest of the creature is fairly dark, but the hair on its head was blonde. And, you know, the driver almost crashed the bus because, you know, she swerved to avoid this creature and got a good look at it in her headlights. It was that close. She and this miner that was looking out the front, you know, described the exact same thing. So was it the same creature over all those decades? You know, does a Sasquatch have this almost, you know, human lifespan, or was it, you know, a series of these creatures that, you know, the original yellow top had created offspring basically that had the same characteristic? We don't really know. But it's interesting to conjecture.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those things. I know we were talking about the size issue that some people have with what happened at Bighorn, Travis. But mm-hmm. we know that humans can reach incredible size. I mean, Robert Wadlow was just under 9 feet tall when he died. And there are, I think the tallest person in the world currently is just over 8 foot. So mm-hmm. when you see things like that, there are always genetic differences, even if we look around the world around us and people, and we see it in different types of animals, that there will be certain genetic strains that are more prevalent in certain populations or whatever. Here we've got people that are noticing a particular creature because of its distinctive hairdo. Mm-hmm. But we know that chimps can live into their 60s in the right conditions. I think the average age for a gorilla or a chimpanzee, that most people say, is between 30 and 45 on average. Yeah. But there are reports of creatures living into their 60s. So once again, we know, even if we look at the world around us and the creatures we're aware of, there are examples that would validate what people are seeing, whether it's height or lifespan.
Sure. And we have... I saw the news article this morning where, you know, the oldest person in the world is like 118 or something. So there are always outliers in any genetic pool. So it's entirely possible that this particular Sasquatch had lived to ripe old age. And, you know, it was in its 60s, 70s, whatever. Or, as I said, it could have been passed along as a trait to, you know, its offspring. Either way, it's a fascinating story because you have, like I said, sightings of this creature, you know, up around the mine from the early 1900s all the way through that time period to the you know, the catastrophic bus sighting.
It's also one of those creatures where I think one of those things sometimes when you read these reports and you think, what the hell are you doing? Where I think one of the early reports, two miners thought they saw a bear eating blueberries or blackberries or something and threw a brick at it. And I'm just like, what are you doing? And it just got up and walked away. Luckily for them, well, I would suggest.
Luckily for them, yeah. I mean, you see a lot of these stories of these early Sasquatch stories, these creatures are met with gunfire,
yeah.
You know, because they don't know what it is. So, you know, the human, unfortunately, the human tendency with things that you can't identify a lot of times is to try to destroy it, which I don't necessarily think is the best reaction. But I can understand if you lived out in the wilderness and in the early 1700s or whatever, and you'd been primed with stories of monsters and what from your youth, you know, you might be a little freaked out by something like Sasquatch. Yeah. The interesting thing to me, though, is that you have all of these stories of hunters who've sighted these creatures and even actually watched the creature through their rifle scope. Nobody's taken a shot at one because, you know, in the attitude seems to be very much the same as the, the attitude of the one witness who said, you know, he's got more right to be out here than I.
Yeah.
Or it never even occurs to them to shoot at the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a story in the book about somebody who did actually shoot one and claims to have killed it.
Mm.
But he was hunting moose illegally or deer illegally. And, didn't make a report. So we just have his word for it. But it was a fascinating story because he, you know, gets up close enough to this creature to kick its hand over and make a very detailed drawing of how it was and how it was laying and so forth. So there's all kinds of good stuff in the book. So if you're a Sasquatch aficionado, I definitely, I would recommend it to you because there are all kinds of interesting stories. And if you're a flesh and blood person, there are plenty of visual sightings of the creature and people interacting with. However you look at your Sasquatches, you're going to be happy.
Well, very true, very true. I think one of the things that's really struck me with some of these reports and the closeness that these people have got, Travis, I think is some people have even described seeing the wind blow the hair, which is something you have to be a certain distance away from to sort of see any kind of creature for that to happen. And I think, you know, there are some amazing reports. I think the last one I want to touch on before I let you return to the comfort of your securely locked home is the wonderful encounter of Liz Manley, which I think's in Nova Scotia, who was an EMT, wasn't she?
Yeah. So actually, I think that was in Alberta.
Ah.
Because it was an oil field.
Oh, yep.
She's coming out of an oil field. So Canada, very rich supply of oil. And some of those oil fields are actually in wilderness areas. So this woman was, she was a medic for, I think she's probably a paramedic for an oil field because she drives a big rescue unit, which plays into the story. They are basically shutting down drilling for the season, and it becomes very difficult to move equipment, move pipe, and that kind of thing. The kinds of things that you need to do to keep an oil field running. So they just shut down during those time periods until things dry out or freeze over or whatever they need to have happen. So this woman is the last truck has departed, and she waits a while because she wants to be sure that she's not following in all the rocks and pebbles and dust and crap that this truck is going to kick up. She's driving the rescue unit, basically. And it's part of her job to make sure that everybody's off the site and everything before she leaves. So she accomplishes all of her tasks and gets in her truck and starts to take off down this very primitive road that leads into the wilderness area. Or into the oil field. She's bumping and thumping along, and you can't go very fast along one of these roads because it's basically just a track that leads out, and it's been rutted by having all this heavy equipment and stuff going in and out. So she's driving along, and if I recall, she first spots this creature in the in a field off to the side of the road, and she thinks it's a tree stump.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, which is something that you hear not often, but you do hear in some Sasquatch sightings where the creature will be squatted down and it looks for all the world like a big tree stump because, and this made a lot of sense to her, perceptually at the time, because what they do is they clear off an area along the sides of these oil field roads. They clear off a kind of a clear zone, and there are all these tree stumps there, right?
Yeah,
where they've cleared things out. So she thinks it's a tree stump until it moves, and she is then faced with the idea that she's seeing something that she can't identify. Now, again, this is a person who has lived out in these woods for a period of time. She knows what an elk looks like. She knows what a bear looks like. She's, you know, had encounters with these. She's even, if I recall, she'd even seen a wolverine, which is very, very rare sighting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And deer and all these things. She's looking at this thing and her mind is just not clicking. She's like, I don't know what I'm looking at. Until she realizes that she's looking at a large bipedal, dark hominid, no shoulder, no neck, you know, the classic Sasquatch, right?
Mm.
Again, not something that had entered her mind at all. You know, I don't know that she was really a skeptic. It's just she never even thought about these things, right?
Mm.
And hadn't heard any reports or anything of the kind that would have cued her to be thinking Sasquatch, right?
Mm.
So it takes her some time perceptually to come to a realization of what she's looking at. And of course, you know, as with a lot of roadside sightings, the creature is just kind of walking along, minding its own business, going wherever it is Sasquatches go when they go for a walk in the woods. But she, you know, she's looking and she got a good look at this thing because if I recall, it's early morning and the sun's not up completely, but she's got her headlights on high beam.
Yep.
And she's got this creature in her high beams as and then, you know, her high beams are bouncing up and down. And she's, of course, slowing down because she doesn't know what she's looking at.
Mm.
And then she realizes that she's looking at a Sasquatch and she decides, gosh, maybe I should get the hell out of here. Because she starts to have that fear reaction that we were talking about, right? And so she speeds up and, you know, exit stage left, but she has a, you know, classic roadside Sasquatch encounter in process. So the thing that struck me about that story, though, was her whole thought process. It's like, oh, that's a tree stump. Oh, that's some kind of an animal. Oh, what kind of an animal is that? I don't know what I'm looking at. I think that's a Sasquatch. Yeah, you can almost hear the gears turning in her head as she's telling the story, right?
Yeah.
Because, again, this was not something that she was queued up to think of. You know, it's not like there were stories of Sasquatch in the area or some, you know, half the guys that had sightings or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
She just saw Sasquatch, and it was so out of her mental range that it took her some time to figure out what she was looking at. Yeah. And those are the kinds of sightings that I love. It's like, you know, it's not the person who's like, ah, yeah, look, it's a Sasquatch as soon as they see something in the woods. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is somebody who had to think it through and really, you know, come to a conclusion that they were looking at something that wasn't supposed to exist.
Mm.
So her story is, to, you know, again, one of those really super credible ones. Again, you know, you have this professional who'd spent time in the woods, who was used to doing acute observation, because if you do, you know, the kind of work that she did, you know, you have to monitor people and make quick judgments about how they're doing, if they're injured or sick or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, she, again, very, very good witness.
Yeah. Well, it's chock full of encounters and stories like this that really make you question any kind of explanation that tells these people that they're seeing bears or mooses or birds or anything else, tree stumps, as we just referred to, from all over. And I think one of the great things is that you've got a collection, as we said about the book being beyond British Columbia, that really focuses on the fact that this is happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's full of stories in the modern era. We've several witnesses this century, so it shows that this is not something that you can kind of dismiss as old wives' tale or tales of a tale. These are reports that are going on right now all across Canada.
Yeah, and they continue to happen.
Mm-hmm.
As I was bringing the book to publication, there was another story from Northern Ontario where a guy had taken a video that
sure looks like a Sasquatch.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't like to get into, and I talk about this in the book, I don't like to get into the video thing because it's just so easy to fake stuff nowadays. And it's like, and you get this war going back and forth between the true believers who are like, oh, it's a Sasquatch. And then you have the skeptics who are like, oh, it's Photoshopped or whatever.
Mm.
I don't want to have anything to do with that. You know, I'm more interested in what the witness has to say. But yeah, it's still happening. There are still people seeing Sasquatch in the wilderness in Canada. You know, I mean, there might even be a sighting today. Who knows? But it continues to happen.
Yeah, brilliant. So, Travis, where can everybody follow your work and get a copy of this book? And what's next for you, though? I think you've hinted at it at the beginning of the conversation that I don't think Sasquatch is ready to let you go just yet.
Sasquatch has not let me go. I'm down the rabbit hole now. There's a whole range of encounters in the wilderness that, you know, like the BFRO and other people refer to as Class B sightings, where the person doesn't actually see a Sasquatch, but they have a strange encounter in the forest, in the wilderness. You know, whether it's tracks or vocalizations or rustling in the brush or things that are being thrown at you, or particularly rocks being thrown at you, those kinds of things. So I'm going to take a closer look at Class B sightings in the next book in this series, I guess. As to where you can find the book, as always, it's available on Amazon. It's available on Kindle and as a paperback, both. If you have Kindle Unlimited, it's free. You can't ask for much more than that, right?
Yeah.
It's available through Amazon. If you wanted to interact with me, I'm on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Instagram is the kind of strange one. It's Kurunir, Kurunir 60. I'm WT Watson 2 on Twitter. And you can find my W.T. Watson author page on Facebook, or my personal is Will Watson, which is kind of a long story, but it's how I ended up on Facebook. you'll know that you have the right account if you find stories, or if you find a feed about Sasquatch Canada and Mysteries in the Mist and all my other books. So.
Brilliant. Well, thank you as always. I know when you sent me an email, I think it was one of the easiest bookings. I've got a new book coming out about Sasquatch, Paul. Okay, when do you want to talk?
I know that you just detest Sasquatch and hate talking about it, right? I know it's one of your favorite topics, so I was excited to have a chance to talk Sasquatch with you.
Absolutely, and especially as I've been wanting to really dive into some stories from Canada as well. So thank you very much, Travis, as always. And like I say, the book is brilliant. It's chock full of stories from all angles of the Sasquatch conundrum, so I'm sure there's something for everybody in there. And as always, thank you again for your time, and I look forward to seeing where the rabbit hole throws you out next.
Yeah, I think that this next book is probably going to set the flesh and blood people on their ears a little bit, but that's okay. I'm used to being controversial at this point. Thanks again for having me, Paul. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to come on and chat with you.
Thank you, as always, my friend. I look forward to our next conversation.
Okay.